The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I bring you greetings today from the miserable, poverty-stricken land of Great Britain. That's the picture that the New York Times has painted. If you read the New York Times yesterday, these are austere times for little England. It says, a walk through this modest town, speaking of Prescott, it's a northwestern town in England. It says, a walk through the modest town of this town in northwest of England amounts to a tour of the casualties of Britain's age of austerity. That's the age we're living in, Jonathan. The age of austerity. The old library building has been sold and refashioned into a glass-fronted luxury home. The leisure center has been raised, eliminating the public swimming pool. The local museum has receded into town history. The police station has been shuttered. Now, as the local government desperately seeks to turn assets into cash, Brown's Field, a lush park in the center of town, may be doomed too. It all sounds so terrible. The government, of course, doesn't care about the poor. It's just selling off government assets to help the rich to get richer. This is what the New York Times wants you to think about this little northwestern town of Prescott. Here in the UK, yesterday I had a program on the media roller coaster from swooning to apoplexy. And of course, I focused in that show about the coverage of two presidents, the Obama administration, and then the way that they've approached their coverage of the Trump administration over the last year and a half. But here's another good example of how the major media lie. They might make statements that are true in the narrowest of senses, but they leave out the most crucial facts. And like in the case of this story about Prescott, they give a completely false impression. Richard was telling me, he's the one that alerted me to the story this morning, but he said just a few minutes ago that he was on the Prescott Library website. Everything's still working fine, still functional, still open for business, still very much in existence. The Leisure Center, spoken of at the in the introduction of that piece, the old one was demolished. And that did eliminate a public swimming pool, but there's another one, a bigger one in Prescott. It's still up and running, and it has two public swimming pools. A little town with a nice leisure center, two public swimming pools. The police station, as the Times brings out, has been shuttered because a brand new police station opened in January of this year, just a few months ago. And the museum, It's still up and running as well. I think I mentioned the library. Richard said that the old one had been sold, but there's a new one that's since been opened. So literally everything that the New York Times mentioned in the introduction of its article yesterday was wrong. Everything. And that just highlights, as I've said, that they're more interested about pushing an ideology than they are about reporting the facts. I mean, really, if you wanted to look at cities that are falling apart, you could find a compelling story in San Francisco, as we talked about a few weeks ago, or more recently, Seattle, which is implementing a head tax to try to combat the problem of homelessness. This was just a couple of weeks ago. I've been meaning to get to this story, but Seattle City Council, they voted 9-0 to approve this new tax. And it's meant to combat homelessness. supposed to raise another $50 million for affordable housing because there's so many homeless in Seattle, this city where there's all of this corporate wealth, Amazon, Starbucks. Reuters, just to paraphrase some of the bits from it, all of these Seattle-based stalwarts, as Reuters says, Starbucks, Nordstrom, Apple, Google, Facebook. Bloomberg said this about the new head tax. It says under the new law, companies bringing in more than $20 million in revenue a year would be required to pay $275 per employee every year. So Amazon, this behemoth, I mean, and they don't like this. These are left-wing corporations that are making the city and the region of the Northwest a ton of money and revenue and taxes and such. But now the city council, the local government, wants more money. They need it because there's so many homeless in Seattle. Well, the council originally wanted $500 per employee, and it's now at $275 after Amazon put the halt on its expansion plans for office space. Put 7,000 jobs in jeopardy. And then the city council wised up and said, well, you know, maybe we might want to reduce this sum. Starbucks came out criticizing the tax. I mean, it says something when these left-wing corporate giants are so fed up with these left-wing policies of higher taxes and more government spending that even they criticize the local government. It says in a statement, Drew Herdner of Amazon said that Amazon was disappointed in the vote and remains very apprehensive about the future created by the council's hostile approach and rhetoric toward larger businesses, which forces us to question our growth here. He said the city does not have a revenue problem. It has a spending efficiency problem. That's the problem with Seattle. That's the problem with the 12,000 homeless. And yet here comes the New York Times yesterday focusing in on little Prescott, UK, because we're in times of austerity in Britain, because they've reduced government spending by a fraction of a percentage. And everything's falling apart, the New York Times would have you believe. Now listen, Britain's got a lot of problems, and we'd be the first to tell you that. But the focus here, and just the complete disregard for facts, it's all about the agenda. It's all about the ideology. If they're looking for a story, any story that would say, hey, we need more government spending, they'll go find it. And they'll create a narrative. And meanwhile, these cities where city spending is booming, San Francisco, Seattle, they don't know how to solve the problem of homelessness, of drug addiction, of opioid overdoses. They can't solve it. They're trying. They're trying to raise more taxes, even a head tax. Every business, well, at least the wealthy ones, $275 a year per head. 12,000 people are homeless in the Seattle metropolitan area, and that's the third largest population of homeless people in the country, this city. This city of Starbucks and Apple and Google and Nordstrom. Or to add San Francisco to the mix, Facebook, Silicon Valley. Last year, Seattle spent $68 million on just homelessness alone. $68 million. I mean, you can do the math on 12,000 people who are homeless. That amounts to something like $5,600 per head. And now they want to add more to that with the new head tax that Amazon's going to chip in on. They want tens of millions of dollars more to combat homelessness. That's what the city council is recommending. 2/3 of this new tax of something like $50-60 million They're recommending that it go toward low-income housing units. But there's not much of a focus in the left-wing media on this. Because, well, I mean, they've had left-wing leaders in Seattle and San Francisco for decades. I touched on this a few weeks ago. I mean, you look at San Francisco, just to switch to that example. I think that area only had 10% of their citizens vote for Donald Trump in 2016. It hasn't had a Republican mayor since 1964. This is a bastion of left-wing rule. This is from the San Francisco Business Times. The top four candidates in the current mayoral race, an African-American woman, an Asian-American woman, a Hispanic woman, and an openly gay man, will all be firsts no matter who wins the special election in June. Also certain, the winner will be a Democrat. So they have the Democrats. They have the big spenders in place. And they can't figure out how to clean up the filth on the streets. That example I gave for you a few weeks ago, they had this envoy from the United Nations visiting the city of San Francisco. And she compared the inner city streets of that city to Mumbai and Mexico City. And here they are just pouring more and more money into both of those cities. San Francisco, Seattle. And more lives are being ruined because of the broken home, because of the drug addictions. And so many people are turning to the streets. And as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago in that San Francisco example, you know, they'll have some few reporters that will actually go and try to get to the facts. There's a few left. But then not even every once in a while, nearly every day, every other day, you get reporting like you got yesterday in the New York Times. Poor little Prescott. They're dying in Prescott. The buildings are vacant. Maybe they should convert those buildings to affordable housing and ship the homeless from Seattle over there. I mean, just judging by the reporting of the New York Times, this report from San Francisco a few weeks ago, they interviewed a homeless man. He rather likes it on the streets. He gets plenty of food, he said. He has good neighbors, quote unquote. He can get a free shower from this charity group or nonprofit or whatever it is. And so here these city councils come along and they dump more and more money into the cities. And the problems get worse because they don't address the cause, of course. They're not trying to fix the broken family. They're not trying to fix the problem in the home. More and more people just ruin their lives. They get addicted to drugs. They end up on the streets. They feel hopeless. They feel like they have no future. And government, human government, is constantly looking for ways to deal with the effect and not the cause. And the effect, more and more, dealing with the effect, more and more, is just simply a matter of raising taxes and putting more money into these government programs or starting new government programs. The problems of this world, the problems in Seattle, the problems in San Francisco, the problems in the UK, and there are lots of them. They're spiritual in nature. That's something that Herbert Armstrong said over and over again, and he wrote about it often as well. Here's a clip from a message that he gave in 1981, clip one.
Now we've accomplished many things in a materialistic way, but we have also found our troubles have escalated, and the world is full of troubles and evils and of suffering of every kind. And all of our problems that we can't solve, all of our troubles and evils are spiritual in nature. All of our accomplishments are physical and materialistic in nature. But the human mind is so constructed that without the Holy Spirit of God, it cannot understand, it cannot conceive spiritual truth or spiritual knowledge. No wonder the people in the world don't understand spiritual knowledge. You know, the most highly educated people in the world with the greatest degrees of letters after their names are the most ignorant because they don't have any spiritual knowledge. They've been educated in a lot of materialistic knowledge. They don't have any knowledge of spiritual things, and all of our problems and troubles and evils are spiritual in nature, and so they can't solve them. The greatest minds can't solve our problems in this world. That's where our troubles come from.
The troubles so often come from the most educated, the greatest minds. I mean, here are great minds writing for these great newspapers, or what used to be great newspapers. And like I said yesterday, and then again here today, I mean, look at how little facts are in some of these stories. Poor little Prescott, the New York Times says. Forget about Seattle. Forget about San Francisco. Let's focus on Prescott because the land of Britain, don't you know, is in a period of great austerity. I mean, these are austere years. Austerity is changing everything in Britain. That's the headline at the New York Times. That's page one. That's above the fold. Austerity is changing everything. And here Britain has made, over the last few years, the tiniest of tiniest cuts in government spending. But in the view of the New York Times, a tiny cut is way too much. And no wonder Britain has turned into an impoverished wasteland. We need more government. We need more spending. And look at this narrative right here that I've written. Look at what we've created. Look at the misery and the suffering in Prescott. That's just one city of many in the UK. No context, no facts, just an agenda. When Britain's Labour government came into power in 1997, this goes back 20 years, just a little over 20 years ago. They came in and, I mean, they started to expand the role of government in every sector of society. The spending went from something like £480 billion. That's even adjusted for inflation. That's 1997. It went from £480 billion to £760 billion by the time that Labour left office in 2010. So that was 8 years ago. In a span of 13 years, it went from £480 billion to £760 billion. The government, the UK government went from spending 36% of the British GDP to where today it spends 46%. Or I think that's actually 2010 as well. So huge, massive increases in spending. And like I say, Labour government was in power until 2010. And then when the new government comes in, these are the more conservative ones. These are the mean-spirited ones that want to make people suffer in Prescott. They want to close down the museums and the libraries. The new government in 2010, they were confronted with Britain's highest levels of debt since the 1960s. I mean, they were still paying off World War II loans in 2010. So the conservative government comes in and had to make some cuts. It's not like the United States where they can just print their own dollars. It's not like the United States where they have their own reserve currency. And so they just print paper. Spend. I mean, for other nations, it's not quite like that. although deficit spending is certainly a big problem here, like it is with many Western nations. But here comes the new conservative government. 2010, as I say, the government's spending $760 billion. And by 2015, get this, listen carefully. These are the austerity years. As they reduced government spending from $760 billion to $740 billion. Minuscule. This is hardly reversing the so-called labor revolution. It's just a tiny, tiny, tiny little cut in spending. But it's a cut nonetheless. And then here comes the New York Times hatchet job. How did the UK survive back in the mid-1990s? When the government was only spending $480 billion, even if adjusted for inflation. The Spectator notes this about the so-called austerity years that we're now living in here in the UK. Jobs during these seven austerity years, jobs were created at a faster rate than under any government time in recent history. The incomes of the poorest have risen while the incomes of the richest households have fallen. So there's more equality. That's what the liberals want, right? The New York Times, though, writes about Britain struggling with itinerant jobs replacing full-time positions and robots substituting for human labor. The reality, though, is that there's a million more workers with full-time jobs than at the start of the so-called austerity years. The Times also complains about the cuts made to the elderly, but they fail to mention that the number of pensioners living in poverty is at an all-time low. They leave out that fact because they're only concerned about telling you that, look, this city in the UK is in really bad shape because the UK government has reduced spending. Now, as I say, none of this is to suggest that Britain is paradise. The nation has a lot of problems, but those problems, like Mr. Armstrong brought out in that clip I just played, they're spiritual in nature. They're spiritual in nature. Lack of government spending is not a problem for the British government. If anything, it's the deficit spending that poses a grave danger. But just leaving all that aside, the spiritual problems are the cause, and man is incapable of solving our many, many problems because we're cut off from God's Holy Spirit. We've been able to create all kinds of technological marvels, for sure. But look at the problems in our nations. Look at the problems in our cities. Look at the problems, the many problems in our homes. Here's Mr. Armstrong again from a sermon in the 1980s, clip two.
It's awesome, the things we can do. Look at the wonderful machines man has made. Look at the conveniences we have that man has been able to think out and invent, and the things that man can do. But every one of those things are physical and material. Man cannot do spiritual things. A man goes to the moon and back safely. And then he divorces his wife or she divorces him. The family is broken up. Why? We do wonderful things, but the wonderful things man has accomplished are all physical and material. But when you get into his troubles, he's full of troubles, and he can't solve his troubles. Why? His troubles are spiritual in nature.
Now, if you want to get into the subject of the troubles in Britain or in the United States, we'll lead the way here. But it's incredible, really, to look at the troubles that a great institution like the New York Times sees. The problems that this world sees Look at the crazy reaction yesterday that just filled the news cycle in the United States. Really, it got traction internationally as well. Something that a TV star, a TV celebrity said or tweeted, I guess. And that dominates the news cycle. That's all that you hear. That's the big problems that we're wrestling with. The major media, social media would have us believe. The problems are bigger than that. They're spiritual in nature, like Mr. Armstrong said. And mankind, I mean, they need the knowledge in Mystery of the Ages, in the Wonderful World Tomorrow book, these classic works of Herbert Armstrong, that will help you to deal with the cause of our troubles, the cause of our problems. That's where we make the fix. That's where the fix can be permanent. It's quite an example he gave in that last clip. Here a man can go back and forth to the moon, and then he gets home and divorces his wife, and his children suffer, the home is broken, and on and on and on it goes. Britain's problems, America's problems, they're not going to be solved by human government. God's government will fix them, and it's going to take some time, as we know, as the Bible even brings out. Looking ahead even into the third and fourth generation of the Wonderful World Tomorrow, when everything begins to be straightened out in the home. And the family, the traditional family, the God-ordained institution of marriage and family, will begin to fix all that's wrong with what we see in our society today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is there a more urgent expression in the Bible than the last hour? When he wrote his epistles, the Apostle John thought it was the last hour before Christ's second coming. In fact, it was only a type of our time today. Every detail of what John prophesied is now being fulfilled. Request the last hour. Never before has proper time management been more important, and this book will give you the urgency you need to organize your life God's way. Request The Last Hour. As part of this free offer, request The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong, one of his most popular books ever. If you want to be a successful life organizer, then you need to read The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong. Again, both books are completely free, so contact us now and get the help you need to organize your life God's way. The Trumpet Daily.
I just want to quickly follow up on the bit that I had yesterday regarding the scandals during the Obama years. As you know, I played the clip for you yesterday, President Obama toward the end of his presidency, and those in the Obama administration talked about his presidency as being scandal-free, and he's still out there. A year and a half on, he's still out there making these same kinds of statements. And The Federalist came out with a brilliant piece today with the headline, Obama says I didn't have scandals, so what are all these? What are all of these, The Federalist says. And it talks about the abuse of power, the brazen lying. Fast and furious, to take one example, 2,000 weapons that landed in the hands of narco traffickers in Mexico, and it led to the murder of hundreds of Mexicans and at least one American a border agent named Brian Terry. And it says that the body count would have been much higher had it not, had there not been an armed citizen who shot an attacker in Garland, Texas. He wanted to murder the audience. The audience at this Draw Muhammad contest, you might remember that from several years ago. But the Federalist says here, despite the incompetence, absurdity, recklessness, and fatalities of the program, speaking of Fast and Furious, the entire affair never really received scandal-like attention. No one lost his job. It says there will almost certainly be a tweet from President Trump this week that political media will afford more attention than a story in which an American border agent was murdered with the gun of Obama's ATF. It says not even when the administration refused to cooperate with congressional investigators was it handled like a scandal. Not even when a federal judge rejected Obama's assertion of executive privilege in efforts to deny Congress files relating to the gun-walking operation was it treated as a scandal. Not even when we learned that the Obama Attorney General Eric Holder misled Congress about when he was made aware of the program did it rise to the importance of a Trump tweet. Holder, this is Eric Holder, he became the first sitting Attorney General in American history to be held in contempt of Congress, and 17 Democrats were on board with that vote. He was held in contempt. And yet, who paid a political price for Fast and Furious? Nobody. Nobody lost their job. The media never treated it like it was a scandal. It says here, it's why Obama, the coverage the media provided him, it's why Obama could secretly send planes filled with cash to pay a ransom to a terror state. And most reporters and analysts would regurgitate the justification they heard in the echo chamber. It talks then about the echo chamber that Ben Rhodes created to get the Iran nuclear deal completed. It says many professionals who supposedly deplore the authoritarian nature of an administration that doesn't answer CNN's questions were generally quiet when Obama spied on reporters. We're going to have more on this in the days to come. We've gotten quite a lot of research accumulated to look at the way President Obama targeted journalists and leakers. Here is the media going crazy today over the so-called authoritarian tactics of the Trump administration. But where were they when the Obama DOJ was actually spying on reporters, tapping phones, tapping into the Associated Press phone lines, targeting James Rosen, targeting, the New York Times reporter, I think James Risen, they have similar names. It says spying was also never really given the scandal treatment during the Obama years. Well, it's not even given the scandal treatment today. They're just saying, well, it's not a spy. It's an informant. And the Trump administration should be thanking us. We're trying to protect America here. It says, as Obama's CIA director, John Brennan, became aware of an operation of illegal spying of a legislative branch staffer over torture files and misled the media about it, did the president know? Shrug. The story hardly made a dent. Likewise, Obama's director of national intelligence, James Clapper, admitted he misled Congress about spying on American citizens. No scandal. In fact, both of these individuals, Brennan and Clapper, they're now on TV rubbing shoulders with journalists that just want to report the facts. They just want to give you the truth. Talks about the abuses at the NLRB, the Justice Department, the IRS. Who paid a political price for weaponizing the IRS? What about Benghazi? All the lies swirling around the Benghazi attack. it says here, still a lot about that attack is unknown. But what we do know is that Obama and a number of high-ranking officials in his administration lied about what happened for partisan reasons. Susan Rice went on a number of national television shows and claimed that Benghazi was a spontaneous reaction to a hateful and offensive video, even when she knew it was a sophisticated and pre-planned terror attack. Worse, however, the administration detained the man who produced the offensively amateurish Innocence of Muslims video and initially charged him with lying about his role in the production of the video. This was a blatant attack of free expression. Yet most of the mainstream press continued to take the administration's word for it and report that the video was the cause of the protests. It says here, finally, at the Federalist, this double standard in coverage makes today's often sanctimonious reactions to Trump a bit difficult to take. Well, I should say, it's no wonder they're so hard to take serious today when they collectively freak out over this latest tweet or this latest celebrity. Where were they during all of these scandals? It says early on in that Federalist piece about these statements that the president, the former president, keeps making. Scandal free. I haven't had the scandals, he said recently. The Federalist says now, perhaps the president didn't experience the fallout from a scandal, but that's very different from never having been involved in one. For this confusion, Obama can thank the political media. They gave him cover, you see, through and through. When we come back, we'll get into the Bible study that we had to skip over on yesterday's program for lack of time. We'll look at what the Bible has to say about loyalty. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine.
The Trumpet Daily.
You don't see too many examples today of loyalty to a worthy cause. You see lots of examples of blind loyalty, people just going along with what some man says without ever really proving the truth of it. But in the Bible, I mean, and even in history, there's some inspiring examples of people who are really devoted to righteous leadership, or at least a righteous leadership in a national sense, in the sense of fighting for country. The Manchester book on Churchill talked about the loyalty of many of Churchill's employees. And of course, Churchill was known for, well, sometimes for being rude or difficult. But Manchester says those who are shocked by Churchill's treatment of his employees all have this in common. They never worked for him. They never worked for Churchill. And there were a few cases where it didn't work out with this secretary or that one, but there were also a number of cases where those assistants were very devoted and loyal. George Washington is another example. I mean, they did have their problems in 1776 with desertion, but there were also those who stayed the course. Like this one colonel, William Tudor, he said, "I can't desert a man who has deserted everything to defend his country, and whose chief misfortune among 10,000 others is that a large part of it once wants spirit to defend it. A large part of it wants spirit to defend itself. I think I got the quote right there. Sounds a little awkward, but in any event, Colonel Tudor said, look, I'm not leaving him. Look at what he's given up. That's loyalty. Now, when you think about God's church and what Christ is preparing us for, the rule, to rule alongside our husband in the family of God, it says in Matthew 24 that we have to endure to the end. Those are the ones who are saved, it says. Matthew 24 and verse 13, that's going to take some loyalty to Jesus Christ first and foremost. Loyalty, as defined in Webster's, it means faithful in allegiance to one's lawful government, faithful to a private person to whom fidelity is held to be due, faithful to a cause or an ideal or custom. We have to have, you see, faith in all of those examples. It does take faith in order to develop godly loyalty. Let's look at the example of King David, or actually a young David. He had been anointed, but in these examples that we'll read from, he was not yet king officially. But the intense loyalty that he had for that God-ordained position, it has a lot to do with why God would say in the New Testament that he's a man after my own heart. 1 Samuel 24, by the point of this chapter in the story, David, as I said, he had been anointed as king, and yet he was on the run for something like 17 years, I think it was. And Saul was out to kill him. And really, if you look at this history, humanly speaking, David could have come up with a couple dozen different excuses to kill Saul. In fact, he had an opportunity to do so, multiple opportunities. And yet in every instance, he refused to kill his predecessor. David was loyal to the office, even though that king was far from righteous. He was loyal to the office, loyal to Saul, even when Saul was trying to kill him. Even when Saul had been rejected by God. It says here in 1 Samuel 24, verse 1, and it came to pass when Saul was returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. And then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes, by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. So here goes Saul into this cave to relieve himself. And David and his men lined the walls of the cave. And verse 4 says, the men of David said to him, behold, the day of which the Eternal said unto you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it shall seem good unto you. Here they were whispering in David's ear. Here they were. I mean, it was almost like they were quoting scripture. Look, this is the day that God said he would deliver your enemy into your hand. This was very tempting, or it could have been. Verse 4 says, then David arose, the last part of the verse, David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privately. So he went and did that. His men riled him up a bit. He thought, well, I'll go and cut off part of his robe. And then he regretted doing that. Verse 5, and it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. That's quite a unique attitude. That's quite a unique response to what he saw as a mistake. Why did I do that? Why did I show that kind of disrespect? Verse 6, and he said unto his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. See, David was loyal to Saul's office. And there's a wonderful lesson in this for us. I mean, we've gone through a lot of turmoil in this seventh era of God's church. We've seen an entire era, the sixth era, derailed after the death of Herbert Armstrong because of corrupt leadership, because of satanic government. Loyalty doesn't mean you loyally stay on board the Titanic as it goes down to the bottom of the ocean. Your loyalty, your allegiance, first and foremost, is to Jesus Christ. Where is Jesus Christ? Where is the head of the church? As I said recently, that's where we get the nourishment. That's where the whole body is fed. It's led by the head. You can see that in Colossians 1 and 1 Corinthians 12. Loyalty to Christ means no compromise. Verse 7, it says, so David stayed his servants with his words. I mean, in this case, David knew, look, I'm anointed to be king, and God has ordained this office. He's the one who establishes thrones and takes them down, and I'll just let him do his job, and I'll do mine. Well, verse 8 says, David arose afterward and went out of the cave and cried after Saul, saying, my lord the king. And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and he bowed himself. Here he was, honoring that office, not mocking Saul. He felt like that's what he did inside the cave. I've kind of mocked him here. I've cut off his robe. And he goes out later and apologizes. It says, moreover, my father, see you. See the skirt of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the skirt of your robe and killed you not, know thou and see, and there is neither evil nor transgression in my hand, and I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my soul to take it. He even called Saul his father. I mean, that's some kind of honor and respect for an individual in an office who really wasn't worthy of much honor and respect. And it came to pass, when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul, and Saul said, is this the voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded you evil. And Saul was right about that. David was more righteous. But God works things out according to his perfect timing. And there was a time when he was working with Saul, and when Saul had a heart like God's early on in those first 2 years. But he really turned bad. And it happened quickly. And I've talked about that transformation before. I won't get into that again here. But just to reinforce this same point, there's another example a couple of chapters ahead in 1 Samuel 26, where you read about the story of David and his nephew, Abishai and Ahimelech. And here again, they're descending upon Saul and his men. Look at 1 Samuel 26 and verse 5. It says, and David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched, and David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him, it says. So here's another opportunity for David to take matters into his own hands. Saul and his men all sleeping, soundly, in fact. Verse 6 says, then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. Zeruiah, by the way, was David's sister. So here David goes down into the camp with his nephew, Abishai. And it says in verse 7, so David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him, And then said Abishai to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Here again, Abishai brings God into it. This is of God. God's worked this out. God's orchestrated this event. God's delivered him into your hands. He says, now therefore let me smite him, I pray you, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. I'll take care of it in one shot, with one thrust, and you won't even have to bother with it. I'll do the dirty work. You just give me the nod of approval, and then look the other way, and then turn a blind eye. And that would be the end of it. Verse 9, it says, and David said to Abishai, destroy him not. He said this to his nephew. No, we're not going to do that. For who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? One of the more famous statements David ever made. Who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed? So David refused to take matters into his own hands. He refused to do it. Verse 10 says, and David said, furthermore, as the Eternal lives, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against the Eternal's anointed. But I pray you, take you now the spear that is at his bolster, and the cruse of water, and let us go. So here again, he was resolved, David was, to remain loyal, first and foremost, to God. I mean, that's the office that he was honoring here. And I mean, for God's purposes, it was important for David and his loyalty to be tested periodically. He was, after all, he was anointed to be king over Israel. And he's going to be king over all of Israel and the world tomorrow. So God tested him. He tested his loyalty. He tested his faith. And God is doing the same for you and for me. He wants to see just how loyal we are to the truth, how loyal we are to God's servant, how loyal we are to the ministry, to the supervisor, the boss, the father, the mother. It's so easy today. You get caught up in the spirit of the age. Oh, the disrespect and the dishonor for anyone in any position of authority. Now, we have to expose the truth. And there are a lot of corrupt leaders in this world. But it says in Romans 13, I mean, God, well, it says it in the Psalms too. God raises them up and God takes them down. It's not our job. We don't even interfere in politics. We expose evil. But this is God's problem to fix, the problems that we see in our nations. It's not for us to take up the spear and to put an end to this or that in one powerful thrust. God fights our battles. God takes care of these problems. We just proclaim the warnings from God. We proclaim the true gospel message that gives this world hope, that gives real solutions to the many problems of this world, the problems that are spiritual in nature that I covered, like I covered in the first segment. Well, it says here in verse 12, so David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and then they got away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither awaked, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Eternal was fallen upon them. So God was even there. God's the one that brought the deep sleep on all of them. Perhaps to test David's loyalty. Are you going to remain loyal? I mean, these guys are practically in a coma. Nobody's waking up. What a perfect opportunity. But David didn't take matters into his own hands. He let it play out the way that God saw fit. And God's going to test us as well periodically to see if we'll take matters into our own hands or if we'll walk by faith, if we'll look to God, if we'll trust him, if we'll remain loyal to Jesus Christ. Over in 2 Samuel, jump ahead to the next book, 2 Samuel chapter 23. Just one verse over here to conclude with. It says in verse 3, "The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me, he that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." See, these are the ones that God will promote. You can study Matthew 20, servant leadership. These are the ones that God wants to put in high-powered positions in the world tomorrow. People that can rule over men and be just and rule in the fear of God. That's not possible unless we are supremely loyal to Jesus Christ as our head and to God his Father and our Father. We are servants of the Most High God. And God wants to know if he can totally rely upon us to be obedient and submissive under every circumstance. What about it? Are you as wholeheartedly loyal to God as David was? Are we as loyal to God as he is to us? This surely is one of the most important character traits that we can have as a true Christian. True Christian leaders. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us some feedback, you can send emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.